and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk, and we were joined by Phil Brynan, but he's had to dip off. So hi, Joe.
Hi, Jasmine.
So this week's session is a GDPR radio, which we covered a lot, actually. There was a lot to cover, and I'm glad we got through most of it. It was an interesting session. We started off with the ICO in action this week, which, you know, doesn't come around often, in my opinion. There was they fined the Ministry of Defence for their breach in Afghanistan, and the monetary penalty notice was released. We spoke about the enforcement action to the Home Office and also the Serco fine around facial recognition. And then I think we went to Experian from there and the developments in that ongoing case, over to AI and concerns around AI being used in the workplace, to privacy policies, to WhatsApp. And I think that's a very short summary of what was discussed. But what were your highlights, Joe?
Yeah, thanks for that, Jasmine. Like you say, there was a lot to unpack, wasn't there? We discussed, covered quite a bit before, especially before Phil dropped off. We also mentioned about privacy policies and how organisations very commonly state that, you know, by continuing on this website, you accept this privacy policy, and we kind of unpacked why that's not probably the best thing to highlight within your privacy policy. And then towards the end of the session, we unpacked WhatsApp, didn't we, as well?
Yeah.
And had a pretty decent discussion around BP and insider trading.
I think that was my favourite part. Joe's eyes lit up when he's heard of the opportunity of making 1.4 million by listening to your wife's work meetings. And if he'd have done the same, he wouldn't be on this podcast now, and he made that very clear.
I won't just be on the podcast, we'll not be at DPP.
that was a funny moment, to be fair. I enjoyed talking about WhatsApp as well, but I got a little bit tongue twisted, to be honest, because sometimes my thoughts will just spiral in so many different directions that it's hard to actually put that down into words. And WhatsApp is completely one of those areas. It's so context dependent on how you should go about it, and, you know, an organization setting, especially in relation to subject access requests, that it's one of those, where do you start and how do you take a step back and think about the correct approach to it, really, and if, you know, if there is such a correct approach with organizations using WhatsApp, which, you know, we might not always think is the case.
No, and I don't really know if we came to a conclusion on that either, did we, really?
I know it depends.
Devil in the detail, as always.
It is a tricky area, but to be honest, if anyone's got any questions around that and wants to send them over to info@dataprotectionpeople.com for us to talk about it further on another podcast, please do, because I do actually want to get into that a little bit more, because it's such a rabbit hole, and I think that's the best way to explain it, really. But yeah, what else did you enjoy about the session, Joe? I like to see the ICO in action, to be honest, but
yeah, issuing a fine, but then they fined the public authority that they said they wouldn't do, so I wish they'd make their mind up.
I know, that's true. That is true. And as always, they are on the front foot with nuisance calls, which, you know, the unsung heroes.
Yeah, that's the only sort of thing they seem to have appetite for these days, isn't it? Is cookie compliance and, well, it's around the pecker stuff, isn't it? It's cookies and direct marketing is the sort of stuff that they have the real appetite for. But yeah, it's good to see that, you know, they don't neglect that, and they are clamping down on spam calls, although I think they do quite well. The issue, quite a lot of statements in terms of fining a lot of organizations for breach of PECA compliance, specifically regulations 21 and 22. So yeah, no surprise really that they've entered a memorandum of understanding to do with spam calls and text, but keep an ear out for that one, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll let you get into the main part of the session. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with a session on navigating the challenges from big to small organizations. There's a few, to be honest, but one of them that is worth picking up on in, you know, continuing on from last week's third party session is around standard contractual clauses. So, Joe, would you like to explain that one a little bit? Because you do a better job than me.
Yes. So, for those that aren't aware, although I'm sure most on here will be aware, standard contractual clauses are a mechanism that organisations can rely on under Article 46 for the facilitation of a restricted transfer to a territory without an adequacy regulation. So, if you dial way back to 2021, before I was involved in data protection, there was a set of new EU SECs, I believe, that were introduced, and there was a threshold for organisations. If you'd entered into SECs prior to, I think, the 21st of September 2022, it was, you could continue relying on those SECs for a period of time. That period of time is coming to an end, I believe. I
Just,
saw online on the
yes.
21st of March 2024. So that means that if you are still in that agreement and that transfer is still continuing, then I believe you need to enter into a new contract on the basis of either an international data transfer agreement, which is the UK's answer to the EU SECs, or I believe you can attach the international data transfer addendum to the new EU SECs in order to facilitate that transfer. So quite a lot to unpack there. I know I've just thrown a lot at you,
You
but
did. That was a fantastic explanation.
thank you very much. But the rundown is that if
You've
you,
got to repay your contracts,
yes,
essentially.
if you rely on the old SECs prior to the 21st September, you have 3 weeks today to refresh your contracts, essentially. So lots of work to do. So not to send you into a frenzy, but it's worth noting for sure.
Thank you, Joe. It's very useful to know. So, moving on, the ICO have been very busy this past week or so. I don't know if you've seen that they ordered Serco to stop using facial recognition on their staff.
I did.
So that was a big one. Yeah, so they've issued an enforcement notice. Go on, Phil.
That to me is like the big news story of the week, I think, to me. So I don't know if you've read, I saw a couple of articles about it, and the best one was Lexology because it went into kind of a legal analysis. I'll find the thingy and stick it on the link and stick it in the chat. But it's interesting because I haven't actually managed to get hold of the enforcement notice and read it, but I would have thought it'd be available online. But this Lexology article is saying, they've done a DPIA, they've done an LIA, and they'd been through a process, but the ICO just said it wasn't good enough. They hadn't done a proper necessity test, they hadn't done a proper and a thorough, review of the infringement on people's rights. But this was facial recognition, wasn't it, for work and work attendance? So the reason apparently for introducing it was the paper-based system kept getting abused, but rather than introduce plastic cards or some other kind of mechanism designed to use facial recognition, which back in 2017 when they started, you'd have thought that'd be quite expensive as a solution.
Yeah, for this, for monitoring attendance as well. It's not really
Attendance at
something
leisure
that's
centres, yeah, 38 leisure centres.
vital, yeah.
So again, it seems to, looking out in, it seems, a lot of technology to manage attendance at, not of the participants, but of the staff at a leisure centre. Let me find the link whilst you mull that one, talk about it, or whatever you're going to do about it, mull it over. Or maybe you're
Yeah.
moving on. Are you moving on?
No,
Just
just as
dwell on
a
it.
little bit more information around it. So, I don't know if you mentioned just then, Phil, that it was at 38 different locations for and processed biometric data of over 2,000 employees. So John Edwards has commented on it and I suppose raised concerns around the risks around harm of inaccuracies of security breaches and that you can't reset someone's face or fingerprint like you can a password, which is, really true. I mean, I'm a bit concerned around the security measures with Serco's operations as it is, because what, the chances of this information getting breached, even now, since they've been ordered to stop using it, and this is a high profile case, would this, I suppose, encourage some cyber hackers to try and access this information, and once it's gone really.
Well, it's going to be a processor, isn't it, doing this? They're not going to have built the system themselves, so they must have bought a system off the shelf and introduced it.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a third-party processor, I'd have thought. And we all know that they are not necessarily as good as they say they are at security. As an aside, I read a quite an interesting, bizarre thing. This company called Silence Laboratories, have got this answer to data sharing. You know, this article I read was saying that, or this promo for them saying that everyone struggles with data sharing, but their solution gets around data sharing because basically they host all the data and then allow companies access to it rather than sending it around. But that's not modern new technology, and it's just moving the vulnerability point into, you know, yes, you might, you know, then they become the target. And as I was really confused when I read it, I thought, yeah, this is not new technology, and you know, I can't imagine why it's going to take off. But anyway.
Anywhere. I know. So I don't know if you've seen as well about the enforcement notice for the Home Office.
GPS tax.
So the ICO has issued an enforcement notice and a warning to the Home Office for failing to sufficiently assess the privacy risks posed by electronic monitoring of people arriving in the UK via unauthorised means. So they were trialling or piloting, giving illegal immigrants essentially security tags that were out on bail to track where they were going, but they didn't take into consideration the intrusiveness of this. That was one that I saw today. I found it actually on the ICO's page on X, what was formerly known as Twitter, which I don't have an X account, so I couldn't look through all of the recent messages, but I thought it'd be a really useful place to find updates, really. Because I don't have an account, I could only access that because it was pinned, and then posts from like 2017, 2018. But Joe, you've got an X account, haven't you? So it's probably worth looking into.
I do, yeah. I use X quite a bit. So I will give that a follow and have a look at the sort of news that they share. And actually, while we're on the topic of X, I got a very peculiar notification yesterday on my phone, Phil. I think this will be quite, not amusing, but it was very eerie of what it got. So a notification popped up on my phone yesterday and it said, X has been able to access your entire photo library for 6 months. Do you want to continue to allow full access? And then it said that 2,172 photos and 1,327 videos. And it said photos may contain data associated with location, depth information, captions and audio. And then it gave me two options. And the two options was either to limit access, so not put a full stop to the access, to limit it, or to continue allowing full access.
Right.
I wonder what limit means.
What did you do?
Well, I pressed limit access. I took a screenshot of it and sent it to Jasmine saying, look at what I just got through on my phone.
Right, how bizarre. How bizarre. Just going back to that, it must have been really busy. He's going out to train on the conference yesterday, rattling up all these enforcement notices. Right, got that one done. We're at crew now, get that one. Got down to Birmingham. His keyboard will have been on fire, won't it? John Edwards.
Did you see the monetary penalty notice for the Ministry of Defence has been published as well?
I saw that. I was going to come around that as well, yeah. But they weren't on bail as such, the immigrants. It was a pilot anyway, and they were on immigration bail. So they hadn't like committed a crime and they're on bail. It was like, I don't know what immigration bail, but presumably it's land. You're in the country and you can move around freely, but, you know, you're not in the country officially. So it was a pilot, which is, again, a surprise. So, you know, it's not like they introduced it and it was rocking and rolling. This was a pilot scheme which they've highlighted. Yeah, I thought the ICO said they weren't going to fine public authorities as part of their policy.
But I read with this that the fine was initially intended to be £1 million, and they reduced that considering. Oh wait, no, I'm thinking of the wrong one. Ignore me. I don't think they fined them for this. This is the Ministry of Defence. I'm trying to keep up with you, AFL. So they fined the Ministry of Defence. Yeah.
Afghan breach. Yeah. Well, MOD's public authority, isn't it? But I thought that ICO had said as a matter of policy they wouldn't fine. They'd call them out, but not fine them.
Yeah. So with Go on.
I know what you said, Phil. Yeah, I think I did read that a while ago, and it was something that like everyone in NHS like rejoiced when they heard. But maybe that entry made a reference mostly to public authorities in healthcare. I'm assuming. I'm probably assuming maybe that's why they've gone after the Ministry of Defence, because, I mean, this is probably one of the few things they can go after them, right? Because they can keep saying national security for everything else, right? That they have to do what they do or not share information about issues or breaches. But Again, please, yeah. Please call me out if I'm wrong, but
it's interesting. I mean, the MOD's got absolutely brassic time. They've got no money at all. You keep reading that as well, that they're having to lay people off and can't renew equipment, you know. But, and I thought that it was just policy. It's just recycling money, moving it from one public purse to the next. There's no point doing it. But maybe you're right. Maybe it's just for a subset of public authorities.
No, I did see that, though, Phil. They said that it's a waste of taxpayers' money, didn't they? And that was off the back of the PSNI breach last year, I believe. Mm. So it is quite surprising that they've... quite a hefty fine that as well, isn't it? £350,000 of money that could probably be better spent elsewhere.
It was initially supposed to be £1 million, but the fact that they are a public body was factored into the decision to reduce the fine. So that, as well as the fact that it was a high pressure situation and, you know, it was a mess up in that sense, I think was also factored into it, the nature of the breach. But
where does the money go? Does anyone know? Is it just recycled back into the government? Is it?
Yeah, it goes to the Treasury, doesn't it?
Right, and then they decide who it gets sent off to, or do they just keep it for themselves?
I think I don't know the fate of it. I think it just goes into the Treasury's pot. I think, I don't know.
Into the vault with all the jewels.
Exactly. Yeah. At one point,
someone went to the ICO,
and I imagine all the ICO staff rolling around in Bentleys all the time, you know, with the amount of fines.
Oh, so Michael's put a link in the chat, and he said, he's quoted from the link that we'll see use of the commissioner's discretion to reduce the impact of fines on public sector, coupled with better engagement, including publicising lessons learned and sharing good practice. It will be trialled over the next 2 years.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for that. But I did see that, and that was the first question that popped up in my head. Was, you know, I thought this was going contrary to policy.
I was just going to say I saw something else on the ICO this week. So they've signed a memorandum of understanding with the Federal Communications Commission. So they'll work together to protect people from unwanted nuisance calls and spam messaging. Now, I saw this before I saw any of the other news articles, so I laughed to myself that this was again the focus of the ICO's time. But to be fair, they have been pretty busy this week, so I will let them off.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody's at the IAP conference. I know that Dave and Rob were down there. We had a stand, didn't we? But I mean, none of us went down as consultants to it. I don't think anyone did. There was talk about Tracy or Vicky going down. But I don't know if anybody went down on what their perspectives are. But I saw another thing about facial recognition. A Canadian university vending machine was displaying an error message which said vending.facialrecognition.app.exe error. So all the students were thinking, what on earth is this? Anyway, it seems that this vending machine, for whatever reason, has been processing facial recognition data without any kind of notification or anything, which is absolutely astounding, isn't it, really? University of Ontario. So the company Invenda, who produced the machine, advertises its use of demographic detection software, which it says is used to determine gender and age of customers. Which, again, you know, why
on earth do you need to know that?
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, the funniest vending machine I've ever seen, right, was in Italy, in La Rosia, which is a ski resort, and it had a box of eggs in it, 6 eggs. Imagine that.
Eddie Abu would love that.
Anyway, did you see that? Anyway, they've stuck chewing gum. All the students now stuck chewing gum and paper over where they think the cameras might be. But,
as they should.
I know, it's astounding. But the trouble is that it's just creeping in everywhere, isn't it? Everywhere, everywhere is getting demographics, biographic, you know, facial recognition. It's just going to become the norm, and fighting it is going to become impossible.
Yeah, that's why this Serco breach is really important as well, because it raises the profile and sends out warnings really to organisations that the ICO will be looking for you and will actually take action on this as well. Because it is a battle. It's, you know, probably an uphill battle for the ICO and trying to reduce this as much as possible, because it's like a new shiny toy. So a lot, isn't it?
I know that.
But
really,
these examples, though, just seem ridiculous. Use of money, you know, ridiculous ways to use facial recognition. For what reason is it needed on a vending machine or the staff attendance? You'd think it'd be used for more useful purposes in any organization. I don't know.
Yeah, I think some of the use cases are seem trivial to us, you know. And what it's interesting what the ICO said about Circa though is that that there was a less intrusive method available to them, and therefore the processing by biometrics wasn't necessary. But I mean, ultimately, actually, I found a very interesting paper about necessity written by the data protection supervisor a couple of years ago, and it was like 43 pages thinking about this concept of what's necessary and necessity, which I'll have to try and find a link and put that in because that was quite interesting. Yeah. But you know, what's necessary to one person isn't necessary to another person. But if you're always going to dumb down the technology, I mean, you could use a star chart. You know, let's use a star chart because that's not intrusive. But ultimately, you've got to embrace technology and you've got to move on, haven't you? So you can't just keep saying you've got to use the least intrusive, you've got to use the dumbest form of technology available, because that's counterproductive and it's not that commercial, is it, for organisations?
Yeah. I think with the Serco case, though, you've also got to consider fairness. Like, they don't really have another choice but to use this. There was no appropriate opt-out option or alternative methods. So factoring that into it as well probably adds to the concept of necessity.
Yeah, but it's been, what's amazing though, is we've been running for 5 years.
The Serco facial recognition. Oh my god.
Yeah. So it's been running for 5 years, and now if you're one of the DPO in that organisation, you'd be thinking, you know, I'll review the DPIA and the LIA every year, you know, just check everything's okay. Nothing's changed. No, nothing's changed. It's all okay. You know, nobody's complained. We haven't had any. And all of a sudden, you get this massive intervention from the ICO saying, no, you got that completely wrong.
I'm thinking, though, say, if someone's biometric information is to be disclosed, for example, let's say the face for this example rather than the fingerprints. This, a lot of this information is probably already available anyway. If you think about the ClearView AI case that has taken data from millions of people and apparently lawfully so as well, then what's to stop? You know, what's the difference really if someone wants to get hold of that information?
Yeah, I mean, unsurprisingly, ICO has kind of criticised Serco for the lawful grounds that they'd claimed, like contract. As I know, it's not necessary for the employment contract, which it isn't, is it? You know, you don't have to have time and attendance in order to deliver the employment contract. And it was the legitimate interest that was saying, well, you know, it's too skewed. You know, there's imbalance of power and, you know, people that don't really have a right to object. And then on the special category side, again, they were saying it was Article 92B, which is employment social security laws. And they're also saying, no, it's not required for that. You know, tax rules don't mean you've got to have this technology, you've got to use this technique. You know, yes, you've got to account for people's time and attendance, but not in this way. So again, that's often what we find though, isn't it, when you're thinking about the lawful basis, you know, what is absolutely imperative and necessary for one person, another person like us, reason. So, well, that's not really necessary at all, is it? Hence, getting a second opinion is useful to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder why they go down this route, though, of wanting to use AI in order to track attendance and timekeeping. Is it just for the ease of it, because it's automatic, essentially, is it? Or
yeah, facial recognition. I think it was, you know, people had, they said that there was an abuse of the paper system, so they wanted to have a better system, you know. I mean, people
checking the friends in.
Exactly, yeah, and clocking out late and all that type of stuff. So you could, you know, you can understand the reason, the sentiment for wanting to improve it.
You could have like gates installed though, couldn't you, at your organisation? When I was working for a customer back in the last year, I had an ID badge and I had to scan in and out of the building every time, you know, that I came to work and left for the day. So is that not a sufficient method of...
Potentially, but that's, you're talking leisure centres, so I don't know how many entrances, exits, and, you know, you wouldn't want sort of turnstiles for the customers. But, you know, they said that what Serco said in their defence is that we went out to the staff back in 2017 and nobody had a problem with it. You know, now whether that's documented, what questions were asked, you know, whether there was this culture of not wanting to put your head above the parapet for fear of again it chopped off, don't know. But you know, again, all things that you would normally put in your defense that have been shot through by the ICO.
How many people did they ask? They might have only asked about 5 or 6 people, and they could have just it's fine, yeah, no worries, and not actually consulted further down.
Yeah,
maybe considering the turnover as well.
Yeah, all of this is showing us that getting a really good quality DPIA, LIA, you know, second opinion on it, you know, make sure you've really framed legal arguments properly, got some consultation. This is really, really important, because if you need to rely on this stuff, you need to have a strong defensible position that you've built around you.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of high profile cases, there's been some updates on the Experian case as well. At the beginning of February, the ICO has argued again that the Experian's data processing was unlawful at an upper tier tribunal as part of the legal dispute that's been ongoing for more than 3 years now. So the ICO has long believed that the Experian's marketing services, which has created profiles of 51 million adults, is involved in intrusive data processing. Now, I don't know if you was on the session the other week, Phil, when we were talking about Experian.
I don't think I was. I don't remember him coming up for a while.
No. So a customer of ours, I had a call with them a couple of weeks ago, and they're a housing association and the part of, well, they wanted to take part in the rental scheme, you know, with experience. So sharing tenants' rent data to improve the credit scores, essentially.
Oh, that's what they say. Yeah.
And so the reason why this customer engaged with us in the first place is because a tenant of theirs put in a subject access request and found that they'd been sharing data with Experian, complained that they never consented to this, complained to the ICO, and it was, you know, a bit of a commotion, but it all worked out in the end. We helped them with it, and they decided to move from legitimate interest, which they initially relied on, to consent, just because it's a bit skewy, you know, around Experian, and for various reasons. So since moving to consent, only really a couple of tenants have actually consented to this scheme. So Experian contacted the Housing Association and said, either send us all of your tenant data or we don't want to continue working with you. So they didn't, obviously they couldn't do that. They didn't want to do that. So the contract ceased, which, just while there might not be any direct data protection, you know, legislative breach there, it is, you know, it does make you feel a bit uneasy about it, about how they're obtaining data.
I've always felt uncomfortable with rent sense. So, you know, the sell to the tenants are that you don't have any credit history if you're in rental accommodation, you're not paying off mortgages and stuff like that, but, and therefore this helps you with building a credit history, which could be useful. But the data gets sold into the general kind of data broking pool, which I've never been comfortable at all. And when I first came across this, it was like the default position is, oh, we're going to share everything with Experian unless people object because it's a legitimate interest. And the whole thing just didn't feel at all comfortable or right to me. I've always been really dubious about it.
Yeah, so in answer to your question, Joe, we would just err on the side of caution and, you know, rely on consent for these reasons. So thanks for that, Phil.
But the thing is, right, the Serco thing shows that you're just pottering along doing what you want. So there's other people which they'll be using facial recognition for time and attendance management, won't there? There will be, undoubtedly. And they're now carrying on. Unless they've read this and are engaged in data protection case law, they're not going to know anything about this. So they're just going to crack on as normal, you know, until somebody else has a problem with it and raise it. And then the ICO will go and get them and say, oh, you can't do this, you know. Mm-hmm. So back to what Jill's saying, you know, unless it's debated and discussed in the context of the industry, you know, nobody knows, you know, whether they're on the sound footing or not. You know, if you move to consent, nobody's, you know, demonstrably very few people are going to consent to it, because, you know, if you set out an explicit consent statement, you know, by the way, your data is always going to get sold. You know, I would have thought a lot of people would say, well, I'm not going to consent then. The benefits aren't sufficient to outweigh the potential intrusiveness of the sale of my data and the profiling activities. Don't know.
We were trying to figure out why Experian contacted the Housing Association to say, look, send it all, or we don't want to work with you at all, you know, we want all or nothing.
It's because it's too hard for them, you know, they're selling it, right? So if they've got a much more reduced data pool, then it's not commercially viable for them.
So yeah, but why, what's the problem with having a couple of tenants' data as opposed to
if you're Experian, you know, you're selling millions of records of data, you know,
but if it all goes into the same pool though.
Unless
it has to be contract managed and things like that. Yeah, but yeah. I was wondering if the fact that consent was relied on to share data with Experian, whether that would have any effects on experienced decision to continue working with them, because they Experian can't manage what consent is collected, you know, what they're consenting to on, no, but you know, literally on the form.
They provide, I mean, they provide a whole kit for housing associations, you know, legitimate interest assessments and, you know, forms to fill in. So they would, I actually know, used to know the guy, used to work with him, actually, the guy that was Experian managing this a few years ago. I worked at Everton. He was worked as a subcontractor of a different company processing data. And when I worked at Everton, he was there. And then he's moved to Experian. He's doing this at Experian. But well, he was doing this at Experian. So they would provide a whole kit, you know, put this statement up, do this, so make it easy for people. I think what we're saying, Jill, is just you have to review it and do a, you know, test your legitimate interest assessment. I mean, I wouldn't recommend necessarily moving to consent without doing a thorough review of it yourselves. I think you ought to do a thorough review yourselves, and you know, maybe you think, well, maybe do a bit of consultation with the customers and tenants. So we're not telling you what to do. We're just debating it. But if you have got a link to that, that's, if it's in the public domain, Jasmine, it might be well worth sharing it with people.
Yeah. Someone said in the chat, would consent leave Experian open to more scrutiny? And this is what I was thinking, because if people don't, you know, if they don't consent to their data being shared with Experian, but Experian are collecting their data in other ways, where does that leave them? Does that leave them open, or is there a risk that it leaves them open to, you know, failing to fulfill obligations? So, I mean, I suppose
it's tricky.
It depends in what capacity they're the controller, but yeah, it is a bit skewy.
Tricky. Now, Fred, I've got to go. I'm on this star training, so I'll have to, 1 o'clock. So I'll have to dive off and leave you all to it. So,
no worries.
Thanks very much. Have a good
thanks
rest
for
of
joining
the session,
us.
And have a great weekend.
I see you later.
See you soon. Yeah, bye.
So, Joe, what have you seen? Put you on the spot.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jasmine. I saw a very peculiar news piece actually on Twitter. I don't know why Twitter is my main news source at the moment.
I hope it's reliable.
Well, yeah, Elon Musk tweeted it, actually. It was a tweet from Elon Musk.
All right.
And he got a new laptop. And essentially what happened is he purchased a new laptop, and it would not let him use the device unless he created a Microsoft account. And he then went on to say that this would also mean that this would give their AI access to his computer. So it just seemed quite intrusive.
It seems strange that Microsoft are demanding that as well. You'd think that they were well fed with the data protection measures, even through experience of looking at what they do have in place on, you know, published documents, but strange. I don't know if you've heard or read, I saw on LinkedIn an article about someone working from home, and they worked for BP, and the Darren's put in the chat, you don't need a Microsoft account, he just didn't know how to get around it.
Darren, you should tweet him and let him know.
Genius. But yeah, so someone working from home for BP was on an internal meeting, and basically the husband of this lady overheard conversations that they were having an upcoming acquisition. So he realized there was an opportunity to make some money and bought loads of shares in this soon to be acquired company. And when the merger happened, he made £1.4 million.
Wow.
Yeah. So when the wife found out, she reported it to BP and lost her job. But the husband is now being investigated. But this was in the US by US Securities and the Exchange Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, and potentially facing criminal charges, and his wife divorcing him.
Wait, so he's made the family £1.4 million, and then the wife has reported her husband to BP.
Yeah.
Is she okay?
I mean, I know. She's loyal. She is loyal to BP. They've made a mistake in sacking her there, right?
And she's been fired. Well, it's a lose-lose by everyone, isn't it, here? Like,
yeah.
All she had to do was, I don't condone this, but keep her mouth shut. Well,
you are condoning it. That's exactly what you are doing.
That's crazy, isn't it? Like, the BP as well, of all organisations, you know, the very slimy, aren't they, with what they've done over the past few years with energy bills going up and, you know, it's just, why on earth would you do that? Like, you know, surely you got to give the man a little bit of praise for, you know, noticing a gap in the market and exploiting it. Yeah, his initiative, he made a bit of money.
But, Joe, that is not the point here. We are on a data protection podcast. So, Ben's asked, are you suggesting that 1.4 million profit is okay to start inside trading? I think that's what you are suggesting, Joe, to be honest. I'm going to hold you accountable.
I don't know what inside trading means. I guess it's against the law, is it? But, you know. I just saw £1.4 million and I thought, yes, I'll have that.
You had money signs in your eyes. But yeah, it just highlights the importance anyway of being careful when you're working from home. Are you the husband, Joe?
I might be, yeah.
You wish you were.
If I had £1.4 million, I would not be here right now.
Yeah, maybe one day. Oh, Joe. Anyway. Moving on. So AI has been in the news again. So the ICO has opened up a consultation. Is it phase two?
It is phase two, yeah.
Yeah, on generative AI. So have you done a little bit of research around this one, Joe?
I had a little bit of read about it. Yeah, it's looking around the principle of purpose limitation, isn't it? And around AI and whether generative AI essentially meets the principle in its you know, in the various life cycle of the AI, I believe. So obviously the principle of purpose limitation in data protection law requires organizations to be transparent about, you know, why you're processing personal data and to ensure that it's in line with individuals' expectations. I think the ICO's consultation highlighted that, you know, there's an importance of setting specific and clear purposes at each stage of the generative AI model lifecycle in order to, you know, meet compliance with data protection laws and maintain trust, essentially. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's quite, I don't know, though. Do you think that AI meets the purpose limitation principle?
I suppose it just depends on how it's used, really, doesn't it? So it's not really something that I could probably answer, but probably not in a lot of situations.
Yeah, more I've been thinking about it, I struggle to see how AI even, you know, complies with data protection law. I know there's been a lot of backlash, but thinking about, you know, is it fair processing? You know, I know your data uses quite a bit of uses mainly publicly available information, doesn't it? I believe. Mm-hmm. But if your data has been collected for a specific purpose and then an organization has just decided, oh, by the way, you know, we're going to input all this into AI, where does that leave you as a data subject? You know, are you able to object to that processing? Is it considered fair processing? You know, is it compatible with the purposes it was collected for originally?
Well, that's on the controller, really, isn't it? So I suppose.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not saying this is for AI to consider. This is to you as a data subject to a, you know, if you use a bank, for example, and they've decided that they're going to start selling your information or giving your information to AI or to, you know, organizations behind ChatGPT, where does that leave you?
Well, this is really timely, to be fair, because I read an article about the lack of AI guidance causing problems for UK employees. So I found some stats by Veritas, including that almost 40% of UK businesses are failing to provide employees with any guidance on how to use AI tools, leading to some dangerous behaviours. So it is around that knowledge and awareness, isn't it, and how you should be using it. Looking back at Gemini a couple of weeks ago or last week?
Yeah.
I can't even keep up, but is it the privacy policy or just posted on the webpage about not putting in information that you wouldn't want someone else to see and raising the awareness around the risks of disclosing this information. It is a bit of a concern, especially sensitive private information and how that might be used. It's I do like the fact that Gemini and Google are raising these warnings because ChatGPT, I feel, has failed to do that, for example, or OpenAI.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't take away the concern and the risk, does it?
No, definitely not. And I understand why there's a lack of guidance out there around AI because, you know, it's you know, it's relatively new. People aren't particularly clued up, you know, us included, really. Mm-hmm. But I think it's on an organisation to reiterate, you know, the data protection side of it, to just think, you know, okay, if you're going to start inputting data into this, just make sure that you're not putting personal things in there. And if you are, keep it as low risk as possible. So don't go putting things in about health, you know, biometric information, genetic, racial or ethnic origin, anything like that. Just, I guess, more just remind people of, you know, data protection practices, essentially. You know, if you're not in a position to provide AI guidance, I think reiterating the importance of keeping, you know, data that's inputted in there as less sensitive as possible. I actually saw that report that you mentioned, Jasmine, and I think it was 40% of employees have inputted sensitive information into a public generative AI tool, and a further 60% are unaware that this could result in sensitive information being leaked outside the corporate walls. Mm-hmm. And I think this just reiterates that there's so many people out there that just aren't aware of data protection and what your data means and why it's considered high risk. And I mean, if I go back to before I joined data protection people, or even before I went into the support desk, I didn't know anything about data protection. I didn't know, you know, about special category data. I didn't know that it, you know, why it created more of a risk. I wasn't aware of.
You'd never read a privacy policy, would you?
No, never. And now when I read a privacy policy, it just agitates me because they're always poorly written. But that's besides the point.
but I can see a soapbox moment brewing.
Yeah, well, it well timed, I guess, that, because I did actually see on LinkedIn, I think it was last week or the week before, someone that I'm sure many people on here know, called Tim Turner, shared a screenshot of what someone had on their privacy policy. So this was on a website for an organization. So it said, by interacting with Popular Conservatism website or Popular Conservatism in other communications, you must be willing to be bound by the data practices described in this privacy policy. If you do not agree with any part of this privacy policy, then please stop accessing our website and do not communicate with us.
Very forward.
Outstanding. What an outstanding thing to say. Like, it's just, the mind boggles. I mean, I know it's quite easy for me to sit here because, you know, I've been involved in data protection for 18 months and I've been working with it, you know, daily, and, you know, I've got to grips with it quite easily. But I just, you know, kind of want to raise the issue that, for starters, privacy policies, they're not agreements. You know, you don't ask anyone to agree to it. They're a statement that it's a, you know, a mechanism for you as an organization to inform data subjects of how you collect data, why you collect data, and what you're going to use it for, how long you're going to keep it for, and how you can contact us if you have any questions, essentially, or to exercise any rights. So I just wanted to kind of point it out there. And I think it's a bit of a common theme when you look on privacy policies on websites. They often say, or, you know, they can say, by continuing our website, you agree to this privacy policy. And I just wanted
it
to raise
that. Right, yeah.
No, it doesn't sit right with me at all, because, yeah, what if you disagree? And it's not about disagreeing, is it? It's about it's a method of you being informed. It's your right to be informed of how your data is being used. Mm. And that's the mechanism that's used to do that. So
yeah, I've seen it crop up a lot, just through helping customers with employment. It'll be in like an employee handbook, and, you know, that's another example of it being misused, and almost as if it's a contractual agreement that, you know, that they've not really got a choice but to sign. So yeah, it is something to avoid, definitely. It's not necessary, it's just an extra step for you. I mean I do see as well where people can tickets to prove that they have read it, and that can be a good accountability measure, just to show that, you know, you are providing this to staff and giving them an opportunity to read it and be aware of how the data is being processed. But just be very careful in your wording.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes beyond just that as well, doesn't it, with privacy policies? I mean, how often do you go onto a privacy policy and they're just an absolute mess? You know, they're just, there's bits all over the place, or there's two privacy policies in one. You know, it has sections for tenants and employees and contractors. And, you know, it's just, you've got to make sure that, well, you have to understand that the people that are reading these are not really going to understand what you're talking about. So it's about being transparent, isn't it? You know, that's where the transparent side of fair lawful, transparent processing comes from, that the information you do provide to data subjects is as watered down as possible, you know, without, it has to make sense still, but, you know, everyone should be able to pick it up and understand, okay, so this is how they collect my data. This is what they're using it, why, you know, why they're using it, what they're using it for, how long they're going to keep it for, where do they where do they send it? Do they share it to organizations outside of the UK? What mechanisms are in place to do that? And even like, you know, talking about mechanisms, data subjects may not necessarily understand what a mechanism is, but, you know, it's, you just have to meet the requirements of Article 13, don't you? So don't go above and beyond that. Keep it as transparent as possible, nice and concise. Don't feel like you have to put loads of information in there just because when you see a privacy policy, they're 20 pages long. The shorter, the better, in my opinion. You know, as long as it does what's required of you, then I don't, you know, you can't go too far wrong, can you really?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to have enough information in there. But like you say, if it then becomes information overload, then that counteracts the reason for it, for being transparent, because it's not, you're not going to read through that. But there are various mechanisms as well to make it more accessible and user friendly. You know, if you've got drop downs for different sections so people can easily flick to which part of a privacy policy they want to go to, different, you know, links to click onto for different types of information and things like that. So yeah, if you've got, it's hard to say, isn't it, because every organization is different, but it's if it's over a couple of pages, then you probably got a bit too much information there, depending on how broad the service is arranging. But and even with that,
sorry, don't forget, on. I was just gonna say, don't forget, you list your purpose of processing, don't you? So you might have quite a few, so obviously that may,
yeah. But so I was just, funnily enough, I was going to go into this. So councils that I've worked with, they have different, they might have an overarching privacy policy that includes rights that, you know, apply to everybody, in the transfers, I don't know, just as an example. So information that applies to all data subjects, and let's say all customers, not, we'll separate employees and customers, for example, but then there might be different services within that. So you don't want to include all of the services, for example, as a council would do, which is very broad, wide ranging. You would have different areas for, oh, okay, so this is for grounds maintenance. This is where I need to go for this information. I'll click on this tab. And then it's got the specific purposes, the types of data collected, how long it's retained, etc., in that area. And then you go to another part, which is like parking fines, which I'm too familiar with, and all those kinds of things. And then you go to a different section. So by trying to make the information as digestible as possible, that you can't really go wrong with that.
No, absolutely not. I agree. It's about keeping it as concise as possible, isn't it? But something I often see as well when looking at privacy policies is that when they state the lawful basis, they just say relying on legitimate interests, but they don't specify what those legitimate interests actually are. And we give our customers feedback, don't we, when with privacy policies, to keep purpose of processing in a table along with the corresponding lawful basis. And then when you're relying on legitimate interest, it's, you can specify what that interest is, whether it's in yours or the data subjects. And it just makes it so easy, doesn't it, for you to go through and just to understand actually what's going on.
Yeah, similar to that as well, you see under purposes of processing, we process your data for our legitimate business interests or whatever it is. And that's also not what is actually required of you. You know, you're not meant to say our purposes are legitimate interests. That's two separate things. So something to be wary of as well. I'm sure a lot of people who read privacy policies have seen that crop up quite often, because I see it all the time. But yeah, another topic of a conversation that we could go on about forever is WhatsApp, which I'm wanting to bring up, because it's just a headache. And I think anyone that's, you know, had to deal with this in their own organization will be, you know, they'll be in agreement with me that it's such a difficult thing to manage that we generally try to avoid it at all costs. That's not always doable, but with that, it just brings so many issues. And I've had it come up a couple of times recently, so I wanted to talk about it. But you saw a case that was sort of relevant, didn't you, on X, obviously.
Yeah, it was on X, yeah, kind of. And you were actually questioning me, weren't you, as to whether it, you know, is a data protection and any implications from a GDPR. But I'm sure if you're an F1 fan, you'd have seen in the news that Christian Horner has been under investigation for inappropriate behaviour. And there was an independent investigation that was concluded, I think it was on Wednesday. It cleared Horner of any inappropriate behaviour. However, yesterday, I believe, a Google Drive containing WhatsApp messages and other photos of evidence against Christian Horner had been sent to hundreds of journalists, other team principals, and even the CEO of the Formula One group. So we were actually unpicking this a little bit, weren't we, earlier, Jasmine? And you weren't quite sure whether there were any GDPR implications or whether it was just a HR matter.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on who the information's gone to for starts, what the organization's measures are, what the policy is on the use of WhatsApp messages. Because if this, it was in relation to a woman who was who made complaints against them, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's to do with inappropriate behaviour, so whatever that means.
Could be anything, couldn't it?
Yeah, but if she had these WhatsApp messages and disclosed them directly to the journalist, would that make her a controller, because she's then, you know, sharing that information? If you think about Ring doorbell, for example, if you're collecting data through your Ring doorbell and you don't do anything with that, you can argue it's personal use, it's domestic, it doesn't, you know, yeah, the GDPR doesn't apply. But then as soon as you then use that for I don't know, to post on social media what you've seen about someone and use it against them or whatever reason, then yeah, in some instances you might become a controller in your own right, and the ICO advises on that and to be careful of that. So then I started thinking, well, does that apply in this situation if they've shared that information with journalists? But there is a journalism exemption so in the Data Protection Act. So yeah, I've not looked very deeply into that because my mind was just spiraling off into all these thoughts and I don't actually have any conclusive account of what was shared and who with. But
yeah, it's a lot to unpick, isn't it? And I think I guess I kind of just saw WhatsApp messages leaked, you know, is this a data breach, you know? And then I guess you got to work your way through that, haven't you? Is it personal data? I imagine yes, because obviously you can identify Christian Horner sent the messages and the other person.
But is it caught by the GDPR?
Well, yeah, so is it personal use? Possibly, yeah. But then could you argue that if you've got the team principal's number and WhatsApp messages, you know, is that a regular method of communication for internal, yeah, messages between Red Bull? I mean, it could be quite high up, so you might just have, you know, the manager's WhatsApp message and you just use it for, you know, personal things. Although it, you know, it also could be a professional communication method. So it's the devil's in the detail, as always, isn't it? You know, and you mentioned earlier it will come down to, you know, what's Red Bull's policy on WhatsApp messages, and does it fall in scope of it being professional use or personal use?
Yeah, I had a question. So a customer of ours came to me a few weeks ago with, or last week even, with a subject access request, the first ever one. So the heads fell off a little bit. And this person's requested, you know, all email correspondence, literally everything, all email correspondence, anything between the two managers, any conversations, etc., and also including WhatsApp messages. Now, they didn't know how to go about this because obviously they see WhatsApp messages or text messages or anything as private, and it's deciding whether you can include WhatsApp message, WhatsApp within the scope of a SAR. And we get this question, you know, it crops up quite a lot over the years. This is why we try and avoid, you know, well, we try and advise customers to avoid using WhatsApp full stop, but it's not always possible. So then what do you do if somebody requests information? Do you take that individual's phone, look, yeah, through all the WhatsApp messages, do an information search for the requesting individual, and, you know, take that and then give it back to them? Or how do you go about protecting that individual's rights as well? There's so many questions around it and so many uncertainties, and it's very context dependent on the situation.
It is. And also, if you do use WhatsApp and you do talk about work, how much do you have to talk about work for it to be classed as a professional communicate. Do you get what I'm saying? So say me, I have you on WhatsApp, I'm messaging you, and I start talking about Miles, and Miles does my head in at the minute at work. He keeps using ChatGPT all the time. Honestly, I don't know why he does it. You know, does that fall in with the scope of professional communication, or does it have to be a channel that everybody uses for it to be classed as that, or the majority of the organization?
So there are various things to consider here. So Sam has asked in the chat, what if it's a personal WhatsApp account on a work phone rather than a business account? So that's a good question. So breaking that down, if it's a work phone, that you've basically, it comes down to what you've got in policy, and you need to have a policy on this. That's the first step. So if you need to decide whether you want to use WhatsApp as an approved business channel or not. Now, we've had this question come up before, and it's a really tricky one. And in some situations, you'd have to consider, okay, well, they've got a work phone. It's in policy not to use the work phone for personal reasons, because it might be used, you know, the phone might be retrieved to pull information for a SAR. So that's one approach. And then if it's likely that they are going to have information about an individual on it, then it might be likely that they have to disclose that. You've got to consider these questions beforehand, otherwise it causes a lot of headaches, basically. So Sam, okay, so you're trying to convince senior leadership team that WhatsApp is not okay to use. join the party, honestly. So obviously the issue here is that a WhatsApp can be subject to a subject's access request. Now, breaking that down, Joe, help me a little bit.
Well, there's been an issue, hasn't there, though, recently with people retrieving data from WhatsApp. And actually, I saw something on LinkedIn about 2 weeks ago, and I've actually got it here in front of me. I sent it into our internal our kit chat, and it's that if your organization holds an E3 license for Microsoft, you can now use the communications compliance functionality in Purview to carry out remote e-discovery of non-Microsoft apps. Properly configuring and deploying the communications compliance module will enable robust e-discovery depending on permission groups and roles. The increased visibility creates its own privacy and data protection challenges, of course, but the point was that organizations on an E3 license do now at least have a way to monitor policy compliance and also have an avenue to retrieve messages that may be relevant to a SAR.
Yeah, because the issue initially, obviously, is how do you retrieve these messages? When can you retrieve them? When is it appropriate? And it's very context dependent, so it's hard to pin down. But if, for example, you don't condone it in WhatsApp use, but it's on a work phone, then I suppose in some instances you've got to consider whether it's likely that work matters have been discussed. And if they are, then it might, you know, you might have to disclose that information or retrieve it, because at the end of the day it's a work device and you are essentially collecting personal data on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just replying to Stella in the chat. I pinched it actually from a LinkedIn post from Craig Clark, I think it was. So you may have to do a little bit of, I can't remember if it's an E on the end of his name or not, but you might have to do a little search and find him on there. But I'll put the what I pinched in here for you to have. Sorry, did you ask me a question or?
I guess, to be honest, I don't know. But so obviously the issues with WhatsApp is that it isn't a centralized system. You can't manage what people are using it for and everything. And people still use it regardless. So it's such a nightmare for so many organizations. And it's just putting measures in place to combat that. So whether it's an approved WhatsApp channel or not, what are the measures if a SAR, you know, is to happen?
Yeah.
And it involves WhatsApp. What is your approach on that? Do you want to include it, or do you want to warn staff that it, you know, they may be subject to it?
Yeah, I think it's clear. I think it's important to set a policy, like a WhatsApp policy, perhaps, if it's going to be, you know, even though you might not use it from a professional standpoint, or if you do, and probably set out what would be caught and what wouldn't. So I think what makes sense to me is if it's on a mobile device, a work mobile device, whether it's your personal or not, I don't. If it's definitely a work account, then yes, it will absolutely be caught by a SAR. If it's a professional, if it's personal account, personal phone, I don't see how you can justify that that's, you know, professional, caught within, you know, the a professional setting. Mm-hmm. And then I guess if you go on to work phone, personal account, I think it may come down to the account that you're actually using as opposed to the device necessarily. Because if you're on your personal phone but on a work account, then I think that would be caught. So I think it's based on the account. If it's your personal account, even if you are talking about work, I don't see how you can justify that as being caught under a subject access request. Because you might talk about work in any setting. You know, I might talk about, oh, hey, hi, Jazz, are you in the office today? You know, and I know I'm talking about work. I don't necessarily think that could be caught in a subject access request.
It's difficult though, because what about if that person leaves the organization and their phone is retrieved with all these messages still on, that is in the ownership, well, that's under the ownership of the organization, so they essentially have this information on this individual that they have responsibilities to protect, really.
Oh, you mean if they're on the work phone on the person?
Yeah,
account.
On a work phone. Yeah.
I guess you just have to maybe put in the policy that, you know, upon termination of your contract, that you make sure that you sign out of all devices, I guess.
The phone realistically will be wiped, you know, or certain messages will be wiped, you'd think. I don't know. It depends probably on the reasons for it, for needing that information.
If you're an employee, though, if you're an employee and you're on a work phone and you're on your personal accounts, you're just asking for trouble, aren't you?
Yeah. I suppose, you know, you probably need some sort of disciplinary procedure for if you are misusing your phone, if you're using it for personal use. Maybe if you can block the use of WhatsApp. But I see it with organisations that deal with vulnerable people who, for various reasons, they, you know, that individual would prefer to communicate through WhatsApp. I've seen that come up a couple of times, and from my perspective, you know, behind the laptop, I don't really understand why that might be necessary, but obviously they are really vouching for it in the specific teams, and it's then what do you do in that instance? Do you allow it for a select few individuals because that is the only way they want to communicate, and they can get triggered by phone calls, or they don't have an email address or whatever reason?
Well,
it's because then you're managing another stage to it. It's so complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've just got to look at it and think, are there other, you know, methods of communication that we can have internally? And the answer is obviously yes, isn't it? I think we all use Teams, don't we, to talk, and I think that does, you know, a sufficient job in doing what it needs to do. And we don't use WhatsApp, do we? And we don't use any other communication, really. We might message a few each other on LinkedIn about any sort of stories that we see, but all our dialogue comes through Teams, doesn't it? So
yeah, but we're business to business. What about those that are working with individuals? It's
I see what you mean. So if they haven't got an email,
say for example they're providing supported living to somebody who's, you know, the mental health is in the gutter, or they've got mental health problems, and you know they don't want to deal with phone calls, or they've not got a laptop to have an email address, you know, anything like that.
Then you probably have to use it then, don't you, and just make sure that you set a robust policy or you look for alternate methods of communication. I don't know, there must be some out there, you know. There's got to be thousands of apps that you can use to communicate with each other.
Yeah,
it's a hard one to answer, isn't it?
It's very context dependent, and I think avoid it as much as possible because there are so many issues around it. But if you can't avoid it, then set in place as many measures as possible to structure and to manage the use of WhatsApp, from people's use of it, and, you know, people talking about colleagues or customers or whoever it is, to when that gets disclosed or could be up for question within a subject access request. To summarise.
Yeah, that's very nicely done, Jasmine. We are way over time.
I know. But yeah, so let's close up there. Thank you, everybody, for joining. We will be back next week for a session on small and medium. Miles has just sent me the name of it. I actually can't remember what it's called.
Next week's?
Yeah, next week's. Big versus small. Oh, no, that's not what it's called.
Yeah, navigating challenges, big versus small organisations.
That's what it is. So we'll be discussing the data protection problems and implications and approaches from small to medium to large organisations and everything in between. So we hope to see you next session next week. And thank you for joining.
Cheers.
See you later.